This is Cave Scott Allen of otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Welcome to this episode of Herding Code, being recorded on January 27th, 2017. Today's guest is Keith Horwood.
Hi.
Who is in... Hello, Keith. You're a Canadian living in San Francisco, and you work on a number of interesting open source projects, so I thought we'd talk about some of those.
Cool. Yeah, I'd love to. Thanks for the opportunity to be here.
The first one is Standard Lib, which sounds like it would be something for C programmers, but it's completely different. So can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So Standard Lib is essentially a central registry for microservices, for serverless microservices. We leverage brand new serverless technology and have essentially created like the simplest, easiest workflow that you can possibly have for deploying microservices. And you can kind of think of us like a little bit like a mix between like NPM and Heroku, where we do have this central registry layer, but instead of like installing packages locally, we actually do and cover the serverless hosting for you. So that's what we've been working on for the past year, and it's been pretty exciting.
That's interesting. So if I wanted to use this, would I start off with an NPM install somewhere, or how would I get going?
Yeah. So I'm Node.js is the majority of my background. So we operate mostly in the NPM ecosystem. We have command line tools available in the lib.cli package on NPM. Basically, you would just install the CLI tools, and then we have this awesome command line interface where it's just the lib command, L-I-B. You can type lib create just to create a function, and that'll just create like a Node.js, like a JavaScript function and a workspace for you. And when you want to deploy that function as an indefinitely scalable API endpoint, you just type lib up and then the environment name. And then that's instantly available online as a scalable web function.
I noticed, just by going to your website, so it's stdlib.com, you've got a really cool interactive thing where you can, like, you've got an existing, I don't know what you call it, service, like available. And then I click through and I hit deploy service and it says, give me your, create a username, password, and then it's running. Like that's a pretty quick way to explore it. And is that hard to set up?
So what's really interesting about that, I actually really love our onboarding workflow there. Have a little bit of pride about that because there's actually some cool stuff going on behind the scenes. Like I mentioned, we have a central registry for these services set up, and this registry operates by accepting essentially tarballs, gzipped tar files that you push up to the registry, and then we launch as this serverless service for you. Well, what's cool about that, well, what's kind of interesting, the harder technical part is from the browser, it is very hard to do tarball packaging. So we actually have a service running on Standard Lib that called Standard Lib / tar. If you go to the Standard Lib search page, you can actually find it there. It's publicly available, I believe. So we actually have a scalable service running on our system that does the tarball packaging for you if you just send it up file names and base64 encoded file data. We'll send you back a tarball, and then you can actually send that to our registry. So we're actually like dog fooding through our own in-browser deployment experience, which was really fun to set up and build, but it allows people essentially to kind of have this small little onboarding IDE in the browser to be able to build a service with. Now, I mean, ideally, the workflow that we expect most developers to use, and indeed most people are at this point, is the command line workflow, but it's cool having that option available in the browser as well.
So essentially, I can write a JavaScript function, and with a couple usages of the command line, I can just have it out in the cloud and accessible over HTTP.
Yes, yeah. Not just accessible over HTTP. Well, I mean, yes, accessible over HTTP, but also without like any sort of server management whatsoever. These services essentially live in these like micro containers that scale out indefinitely. So as more requests come into them, instead of doing request queuing and saying like, okay, no, we're already handling these requests, more of these micro containers running your function will essentially be spun up to handle the additional request load. So you never have to manage services. You never have to manage servers. And also it's a self-healing architecture in the sense that if you have an uncaught exception, say in one of your services, and that service goes down, the rest of your containers are obviously still fine and good to handle the incoming request load. So we take care of all of that behind the scenes for you. So yeah, you just write the JavaScript function. You essentially write backend logic that you don't necessarily want to expose to the browser. And yeah, with one command, that's instantly available. So,
gotcha. Sure. So two questions from that. One is, if an exception does happen, what sort of monitoring endpoints or what can I look at to see what's happening?
So we're actually currently talking to a couple of monitoring and logging companies right now for third-party integrations to actually have really great insight into all of the details of the logging. The logging system that we've built out at present is just a very simple plain text dump of errors that happen on your system. So that's what you have insight into. Mm-hmm. We're continually building out a more in-depth version of the logging for, especially for use in production. So,
gotcha. So you have the microcontainers set up and I can have the functions back there, and this being a backend system, I'm just wondering if there's any persistence mechanisms inherently available on standard lib, or, you know, would I be expected to use other cloud applications, cloud databases?
Yeah, so right now, we don't offer a persistence layer, but this is actually a question we get all the time. You can build a lot of like really awesome scalable stuff. Like we have a massively parallel DNA sequence alignment service that we just wrote a Medium article about that actually got a lot of traction, and that was pretty fun to build. So you can build cool compute stuff, but yeah, like you're asking, a lot of additional functionality comes from interfacing with that persistence layer. So right now we recommend people use something like Compose if you're just looking for a really simple database solution, or you can really just use like your own AWS, DynamoDB, or RDS instances. We're also, like I mentioned, talking to some logging companies. We're talking to some cool companies doing some cool GraphQL work, about potentially integrating with some of the systems that they've built. A shout out I would give is to look at the guys at GraphCool. That's graph.cool. They're doing some really awesome backend as a service GraphQL work that a lot of people are pretty interested in. So we're talking to them as well.
So what sort of pricing model do you have?
So that's been a work in progress for a while. We've iterated through, basically we've been giving away our developer tier completely for free for the last few months. And we've been talking to developers and talking to companies about what they're the most interested in. And really what we've settled on for service usage is essentially we're going to be pursuing Twilio's pricing model, where you basically fill up a wallet with a pre-funded amount. And then essentially it's like a pay-as-you-go phone account almost, but for infrastructure payment instead of telecom. But you fill up a wallet, and as you use infrastructure services, essentially you just get those requests deducted from that wallet over time. So it's pretty much up to you how much, it's pay per use, so it's pay per compute. So you pay per compute second used. We're hammering down on the price there, but it's on the order of hundredths or thousandths of a cent per second, per compute second. And then that just, you essentially fill up your account as you go. So you never pay for more than what you use.
Gotcha. And when it comes to serverless computing, I guess you have at least two large obvious competitors. How do you differentiate yourself from like AWS and Azure Functions?
So we're actually aligned with AWS and in the AWS ecosystem. Right now we're leveraging Lambda, and we were actually invited by AWS to speak at AWS reInvent, where we actually presented in the Venetian Theater there in Vegas a couple of months ago. So that was an awesome experience. We're not really trying to differentiate from Lambda specifically. We are offering additional workflow and tooling and like a higher level of abstraction beyond what Lambda itself kind of offers. So we view like AWS and Azure Functions, the phrase I like to use is we consider AWS like the system architecture of the web. In the same way that you have a system architecture on your computer, but you don't write and code everything in assembly. You have these high level of abstractions. What are the next abstractions on top of AWS, and where's the opportunity there? And the companies we've been talking to, basically, and the developers have been, I mean, love the concept of indefinite scalability of things like Azure Functions and AWS Lambda, but some of the workflows are still far too complex. And it doesn't really allow them to ship any faster. It just starts offloading the way they think about architecture into a new form. So we're really focused on the workflow and the abstractions there.
Reading through some of the documentation, I thought you had an interesting opinion where staging environments are mutable and releases are immutable. You can never change them. You can remove them. I was just curious about your thoughts on how you arrived at that philosophy.
I mean, that was through a lot of our own experience developing in a serverless context. I mean, service immutability is kind of the holy grail of development in a lot of senses. Mm. You don't want somebody to publish, especially with like API development, anything that you want to expose over the web that you expect other people to interface with. You want as an API consumer, you want a certain degree of trust that if you're connecting to an API endpoint, that the functionality isn't going to change. A lot of that trust is, I mean, it's just based on like a kind of a social contract between the developers that are consuming the API and the producers. For example, like in a typical REST endpoint, like API/V2/whatever. Now, we kind of wanted to, the opportunity with serverless architecture and creating a registry around microservices is that we can bring like the NPM versioning, like Semver and immutability to the microservice space. So we decided to do that. But that being said, when people are testing stuff in a development environment, they're not expecting other developers to build fully functional services around what they're deploying. So you still need mutability there. So you don't just have like a bunch of development versions that you can go back and look at repeatedly. You're going to throw away the vast majority of those. So we just decided to make development environments completely mutable, but still have the immutable release environments and kind of formalize that what was previously a social contract into an actual technical contract. You cannot change this API service once it's been deployed.
Gotcha. So if I go out and I write a function called do work and I lib up that into a release environment, then I would access it as like, I don't know, scottallen.standardlib.com/do work and then a version number in there. Or after I make a little tweak to it and lib up again, that would be 1.0.1.
You just use Semver. So you'd increase the version on your own. If you try and overwrite a version that already exists, or try and deploy a version that's less, by a Semver comparison, less than something that's already that's out there, the registry is just going to straight up throw an error at you. So yeah, any even just minor tweaks that you make to a release environment, you have to deploy as a new version. Now, if you don't specify the version in the URL string, then it's just going to use the latest version. It's the equivalent of like specifying latest or like star in like a package.json in a Node.js package. But if you want to lock in a version, you just specify at and give the version name. And that's another reason for the development environments, right? Is you want to make sure you can test out repeatedly before you accidentally publish a version that you might need to make tweaks to.
Well, so given that, let's say I do screw up and I deploy something that just, you know, has some horrible error in it. Is there a way to force people off of, like, deprecate a package, you know?
Yeah, so that's something else that we handle as well. So you can do lib down on a package. So you can never overwrite a previously published package. And that's just to prevent bad actors, right? That's to really formalize that social contract. You don't want somebody publishing an API and then overwriting it with something malicious. Not that that would happen frequently, but you just want to avoid the chance that it happens at all. You can remove a package once it's been created. But one of our goals for doing that is we obviously all saw the Leftpad drama with NPM. I believe that was earlier this year, earlier in 2016. So like part of what we do is we're actually building features around automatically emailing because we also give API keys for automatic authentication of your services, et cetera, so you don't have to build auth layers, et cetera. So we can automatically inform the most frequent users or recent users of your API basically ahead of time and say, this API is going to be deprecated and it's going to be removed within 7 days. please update to the newest version. Here's the documentation on it, etc. So that's something we definitely want to take care of for developers as well.
I was looking, you've got a templates feature, and I saw you have one for Vue, which is kind of interesting. So the idea is that then that I would build a single page application that is running against the functions on the back end then?
Yeah. So this is another interesting example of dog fooding. So we actually built this for our own internal purposes. We build single page apps for things like dashboards, etc., like literally all of the time. And a single page app is essentially just a CSS file, a JavaScript file, and an index.html file. So we looked at all the stuff we were deploying on standard lib with like tarball functions, et cetera. And we said, like, why can't we just host single page apps as well? So we actually built our own, we started building Vue apps for our own usage and then realized, like, this is actually super useful if people want to get an SPA out there really quickly. We also have other templates that we're working on too, like Alexa voice templates. So you can super easily integrate with like Alexa skills. We actually have a video. I don't know if you guys watch Westworld. But at the Westworld season finale, we made like a Dolores Abernathy, we made a Dolores Abernathy Alexa skill, and we hosted it on standard lib. It literally took us like 5 minutes to put together. So we're also getting super interested in allowing developers to do that as well.
What were some of your challenges in putting this together?
Oh man. There are a lot of challenges. One, I would say, Lambda itself is kind of a black box. Intentionally, I think the entire point of Lambda in the AWS ecosystem is that you should not have to worry about developer operations. But that also makes building abstraction layers around Lambda and trying to figure out how to do cool stuff on it a lot more difficult because you have a lot less insight into kind of how the system works and what's going on behind the scenes. So that was really tough. And then one of the tough things as well is figuring out the right, I don't know whether like linguistics is the right term, maybe, but essentially the right languages for the abstractions that you're creating. I mean, the serverless microservice space, rather, is so new that there are still so many questions around, like, how do we organize teams around this? How do we access our services? Is REST a good... Like, do we still want to deal with put, post, delete, get with each of these functions? And some of the larger cloud players like Lambda combined with API Gateway and Google Cloud Functions and Azure, et cetera, don't take an opinionated approach. They're like, we'll try and let you do whatever you want, I guess. And the approach that we kind of settled on was, no, we want to treat these serverless microservices as if they're function calls. Almost as if their function calls like on your own system and viewing the cloud is almost just an extension of your personal computer. And getting to those abstractions has actually taken like the most amount of time because it just takes iteration and talking to other developers, seeing how they're using this and seeing what they like and what they don't like. So.
Yeah, I was just reading through your blog post on, let's see, it was titled... Using serverless architecture to massively parallelize DNA sequence alignment via standard lib and Node.js.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought it was pretty fascinating, basically showing the processing you have to do and how serverless computing, you reduce the amount of time required to do these computations by about two orders of magnitude, I think.
Yep.
And that's an interesting read. What is DNA sequence alignment for those of us without the background that you have?
So very simply, DNA sequence alignment is just saying you have a genome, which, like, let's use E. coli as an example. It's a bacteria. E. coli K12 has about 5 million base pairs in its genome. And base pairs are just those single DNA letters that you're probably familiar with, ATGC. Right. So it has about 5 million of those. And DNA sequence alignment is basically saying I have a sequence that I'm searching for in those 5 million letters. I have I don't know whether it's 10, 20, 30, 100, 1,000. And I want to see where it matches the best in this E. coli K12 genome. But I'm not just looking for a direct string match. I'm also looking for places where maybe there's like a 50% sequence identity. Maybe only 50% of the nucleotides match, but they could be in any order, right? It's not just like the first half or the last half or whatever. So that's really what sequence alignment is like comparing DNA, two DNA sequences against each other at every possible alignment position, and seeing how many matches there are, like what the percent match is.
Yeah, interesting. So you can just write a function to do that and then scale it out as much as you need.
Yeah, so DNA sequence alignment is interesting because there are, it's just an interesting, it's a gigantic field. You can use like heuristics about like what you know about the general structure of the sequences you're looking at to like speed things up. Once you hit a certain number of mismatches, you can, there's like something called Boyer-Moore string search algorithm, basically allowing you to like jump the sequence that you're comparing ahead. There's a bunch of cool tools you can use, but basically the approach we took is like, hey, let's just literally compare both sequences at every single position against one another, which is has a time complexity of n squared. But because we can massively parallelize it, we can basically run this function as if it operates with a time complexity of just one, which is a really cool opportunity of serverless compute that you can do. So we can use this computationally exhaustive algorithm that's n squared, but just parallelize it in such a way that it just operates at scale very, very quickly.
Man, Boyer-Moore string search algorithm was my first programming assignment in my C class at college. So that brings back good memories.
That's using the example you talked about. That's using your NT-seq library. Is that correct?
Yeah. So that's that DNA sequence alignment example in standard lib. The reason we were able to ship that so quickly because I built a library called NT-seq for nucleotide sequence in Node.js that actually does a lot of this mapping for you. So parallelizing it out was just splitting up the map step into smaller chunks across a number of microservices.
Cool. I wish I had an intelligent question. I'm looking at the code and I'm I don't.
No, it's fine. It was fun to build. It was a remnant of I actually dropped out of grad school in biochemistry to start my first software startup. And it was part of like a half finished project that I had never quite gotten through in grad school. And years later, I just had a few free weekends and I was like, all right, I'm going to finish this and document it. So, I mean, I think that's the tendency we all kind of have is when we have spare time, we get antsy. So we just start spontaneously writing code. So,
you know, a lot of the examples that you see out there, sort of lambda-ish kind of things are sort of simple examples. And, you know, if you're building a real solution, which may have lots of these services, seems like things could get pretty complex pretty quick. And like how you manage them all and how do you have like sort of a coherent solution? Are there thoughts about like how to manage that, how to, you know, sort of assemble these set of collaborating services in a way that you won't go insane?
I mean, that was actually one of the initial design goals of standard lib. That was the opportunity, and that's actually like why we're called standard lib and built the registry to begin with. Because we noticed the biggest complaint that people had was like serverless seems cool, microservices seem awesome, but it just seems like this is going to get way too complex and out of hand way too quickly. So like step one was like, how do we create a registry so people within organizations and like us ourselves, our own development team, can keep track of the things we're building? And not just through GitHub, also in a way that's like discoverable. We know what services are actually live. So that was, that was really the goal of the registry. And then when I talk about like us spending a lot of time on abstractions and just how you interface with this from other languages, even the Node.js abstraction, like, okay, you have all these services in this library. How do we make it so that developers can access any of these services as easy as possible? So they don't have to go and like discover the documentation and download SDKs and do all of this stuff just to interface with a web service. And that's actually the lib package in Node. It's like the NPM package, literally just LIB. If you have a service, say actually the DNA sequence alignment service, I've published that on standard lib at keith/sequence. So it's literally like two lines of code to actually incorporate it into your own project. You just do require lib, like LIB, and then you can do lib.keith.sequence and then call that as a function. And then you're using the DNA sequence, the massively parallel DNA sequence alignment function I used. And you don't have to install, aside from the lib package, which is like a couple, maybe like 100, 150 lines of code, you don't have to install anything else client-side. So it also reduces like your package dependencies in a huge way, as long as you're willing to connect to a service over HTTP. Which, I mean, a lot of developers now are. It's how you do a lot of your processing, right? Anything from, like, Stripe to analytics to logging, people are doing over the wire now, so.
And are there ways of, like, tracking service dependencies? Say, like, you know, this service uses that service, which uses that service?
We have plans to cover that, not currently. So, I mean, the easiest way to do so is as long as people are connecting to other services using the lib package, you can just, I mean, we can literally just do static analysis on the code that's deployed to see what dependencies the code has. So when somebody looks at it, they can see what other services it's talking to. But also from a standpoint of, as long as you have a standard lib account and you're authenticated to use other standard lib services, you have a complete breakdown in your dashboard of what services you've been using and how frequently you've been using them, and if there's any cost associated with those, what the cost is as well. So
I noticed when I went out to this Keith sequence package or function, I don't know what to call it, endpoint?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so that there's this really nice documentation page there. How is that created? Is that like just a README markdown file, or how is that?
Yeah, so there are two aspects. One is there's a README associated with the package. In the same way that you'd write a README for a GitHub package, we just use the README.markdown file in the top level directory of the package itself. And then for all of the details on how to actually access the functions within the service, every function is paired with a function.json, which is just a JSON description of how the function operates. So you can specify what keyword arguments it wants. Keyword arguments map to HTTP query parameters. So what keyword arguments it needs, like what it does, what the description is, that you can specify all of that stuff too.
So Keith, I'm wondering what motivated you to make standard lib?
The creation of standard lib was kind of a discovery process, both internally as a process of self-discovery, I guess, talking to developers. So I actually, I'm the author of the Node.js API framework Nodal that we launched in early January, to like this massive response on Hacker News. I think we had 2,000 GitHub stars or something within like the first week or so. And we knew we were kind of onto something. And lots of people like from tons of different companies. I mean, I think we had developers that we have developers at like the BBC, New York Times, et cetera, playing around with Nodal, asking questions about it, some people contributing. And I'd been playing with serverless architecture for like a long time in production. And the original goal of what we were going to do with Nodal was create a platform as a service, or like a backend as a service around Nodal. And that's what Polybit, we have a corporate entity, and that's Polybit, was originally created as a startup that was like this backend as a service for Nodal. What we stumbled upon through essentially just through problem discovery and talking to developers is that people really like Nodal, and it's great as an open source framework. And in fact, we use it with standard lib to some of our backend framework stuff. But what people were asking for once we launched the platform was they mentioned that they really liked our workflows for deployment and service management, but not everybody who came on necessarily wanted to have to learn an entire API framework. And some people didn't even have like data persistence needs. They just liked our workflows and wanted to use it as like a serverless deploy mechanism. So that's where we started acknowledging some of the larger problems around serverless architecture as a whole, and really stumbled upon the opportunity for standard lib. And that's how we got to this point. So I mean, Nodal's at like, I think it just passed over 4,000 stars on GitHub. We still have active contributions and people asking us all the time questions about it and joining our channel for Nodal support. But we're also now growing this fledgling developer community, really of thousands with standard lib. And we hope there's further alignment there in the future, in that we want to also be able to tackle all of the problems that, that Nodal does, just in a more refined sense with what we're doing with standard lib.
I was looking through the example for Nodal, and it's just instantly recognizable. It's using ES2015. I can write a class that extends from a base controller and then just start implementing methods that are... It's just so easy to read.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That was... I think that was the feedback we started getting when we first launched it. So Nodal was created at this weird time in, I would say, this unique opportunity in like JavaScript history, where the IOJS Node.js split had happened in early 2015, and at that point I was the engineering lead at a startup with an engineering team of about six working alongside me. And I had been working on really just a Node.js framework to make things easier on my spare time. And I decided to make a bet on IOJS because I said, okay, here's all the ES2015 stuff. Like Node, there's definitely going to be, like Node is going to catch up at some point. So I'm going to make a bet on IOJS. And the biggest thing I miss about working in Ruby, I mean, JavaScript's my jam. But the biggest thing I missed about working in Ruby was how awesome Rails was. And what ES2015 did, especially with the class syntax, was allowed me to bring a lot of similarities anyway in the abstractions from Rails into the Node ecosystem. So I built this out all on IOJS, and then when the Node-IOJS merger happened, we essentially had one of the first fully-fledged, fully-tested ES2015 Rails-like frameworks. And that was just a unique position to be in. And I think that's one of the reasons that Nodal just caught on so well when we launched it. So,
Pausing. Sorry.
That's cool.
Yeah, I was reading through code. Let's see. Inside the controller, you're using error functions. Everything's very clean. And I noticed you're using some sort of ORM. So what is this? What's going on?
Yeah, so what's interesting there, that was actually one of the most exciting things about building out Nodal, is that we built out our own ORM. Now, a lot of people would take a step back and be like, actually, we got this question a lot, and be like, why in the name of heck would you build your own ORM? But basically, I've had like a large degree of experience like modifying ORMs with Django and in Rails. And so I kind of wanted to try my hand at, it was almost just like, can I do it part of it? But we ended up building out this really awesome ORM called the Composer that I think is probably one of Nodal's greatest selling features. I mean, I think the most popular ORM in the Node space is SQLize. And I would like to think that that the Query Composer in Nodal really stands up well to SQLize. One of the greatest things about it is that it does a reduction. Basically, it just uses method chaining and then reduces all of your queries that you've put into it into a single large SQL select statement. So what's really cool is you can add in all these joins and all these fields, and you're not going to have like the same N+1 issues that you do in like Rails with like Active Record, where if you want to join a whole bunch of stuff in, you add more and more queries to it, etc. It really composes everything down into just one large query. What's cool about that is you can actually go to graphql.nodaljs.com. It opened up the opportunity to actually build a GraphQL parser that translates GraphQL directly into a Postgres SQL select statement. So that was really cool. So you can write a single GraphQL query, and it's translated into a single Postgres query. And the composer, the query composer Nodal, acts as like the mediator between that. So that was actually really fun to, just from a conceptual perspective, really fun to have the opportunity to build out. And just to reference earlier in the conversation, when I was talking to like some of the GraphQL companies we're talking to about data persistence, we're also really excited about the potential to like even open source, kind of pull the composer out of Nodal and open source that as a layer to allow anybody to transform their Postgres database into a GraphQL endpoint. So
interesting. Yeah, I noticed you had a syntax where you could say blogpost.query.join, and that would automatically eagerly load your join data.
Yep.
Or blogpost.include, that would be a lazy load.
Yeah, so when you do dot include, it means that you've already queried from the table and you have the blog post object in memory in JavaScript, and then you want to query SQL again to get the joins. So by default, joins just aren't added. It's just to save like query space, right? But when you use the dot join syntax, I wouldn't really call it an eager load in the same sense as like it would be considered in Rails, just because the query isn't actually performed until you're done the query composition. And you type dot end and then give the dot end function a callback. And then it composes the whole query for you. So, but yeah, there is a differential between there. We generally recommend that you just use the join syntax instead of the dot include syntax. I don't even think we use include anywhere in our production code base right now. We use dot join and dot end almost exclusively. So,
and I'm curious, still looking at this code, I know a few people that as soon as they see the class syntax, especially when they see the extends keyword, they just go off on a tangent and have like Tourette syndrome about object-oriented inheritance. Did you get any pushback against that, or did you get any criticism that was worthwhile?
You know what? Thinking back to the original launch of Nodal, I don't think we really received that much pushback in the around object orientation. I mean, I think it was a welcome addition. What's interesting about the JavaScript community is it's growing so fast, and there are so many new developers that just are looking for better abstractions and better tooling, that as long as it reads easily and they can understand what's going on conceptually as they read the code, they're just happy that it's there. And a lot of these developers, too, aren't necessarily that opinionated. And I think that's why the frameworks like Rails and not to lump myself in with Rails, what DHH has done is amazing, but with frameworks like Rails and Nodal really take care of is just like giving opinions to developers who are unopinionated. So I think people were actually happy, and that was a little bit of a relaxation point for developers.
Good, yeah. So what do you do when you're not working on standard lib and Nodal these days?
that's a tough question. That's almost pretty much all I do at this point, to be honest. I'm probably coding 18 hours a day. So standard lib is a fully fledged venture-backed startup. So, I mean, we have investors and money on the line. So I pretty much spend 100% of my time really taking care of the team, writing new features. I mean, we're actively hiring. There's just like so much to take care of. Previously, I used to spend a lot of time running. I haven't been able to do that recently. I ran quite a few half marathons back in the day. So if I do have a hobby outside of coding, it's probably running. I just haven't not gotten to do that as much as I'd like to recently.
Okay, looking at your GitHub and going back 3 years, you've got AudioSynth.js,
yep,
which is kind of interesting. So that the idea there is you're dynamically generating music and going to the thing on your site, the demo on your site. You've got several different instruments and you can pick between them. How is that now? Even in the past, like 3 years ago, some of that stuff's changed, right? But so, do you have a music background then?
No, I have a background and just wanted to hack stuff together. I think, yeah. So AudioSynth was cool because this was before, or at least right before, I think, the web MIDI and the web audio and web MIDI stuff started coming out, where people started building synthesizers just around MIDIs. And I had basically stumbled upon I was hacking one weekend, and stumbled upon somebody who had generated a wave file dynamically in JavaScript that was just a single tone. It was just a single note. They just used a sine wave at a certain frequency, generated the wave audio data just using using binary data in JavaScript and output it. I was like, this is really cool, but like tones are annoying. I wonder if you could actually make music with this. So I got to work and I started doing a little bit of reading on music theory and how I can turn just a straight, almost electronic tone into sounding like things like acoustic strings, like Car Plus. I think the algorithm is called the Car Plus Strong String Synthesis algorithm. How you can kind of how synthesizers work to like make organ and piano noises, etc., and built a whole library around that. So I mean, the difference between that and what happens now is that this stuff is all pure wave audio data, which is actually how synthesizers like that you would install on your computer work, as opposed to like the web MIDI stuff that I think a lot of people are playing with now. There's a lot better APIs out nowadays for this sort of stuff. But
nice, yeah. I tried playing with some of this stuff when it was too early, and it was like tons of code for like you're saying now. It's a lot simpler.
Oh yeah, for sure. What's actually cool that you ask about that is that that library is one of the reasons that we actually hired our first engineer at Standard Lib. He actually left Google to join us because we met at a hackathon where we spent the weekend building out an audio-based project where people could like record music in their browser, and we used the AudioSynth library to do that. So it's kind of funny how like if you just keep... I mean, I think the lesson there is like if you just keep putting code out there and like working on cool stuff, like eventually you'll start like meeting the right people and really good things happen when you just like put things out there. So
what's coming up in the future? What's the next big thing for Standard Lib?
Oh yeah. So, I mean, we got a lot of really cool stuff coming. So we have the authorization, the authentication layer is actually something that we'll be pushing out in the next couple of weeks. We have some awesome software development kits in languages other than Node.js that will be out in February as well, that we're really excited about. We're also adding additional support for, on our roadmap is to add additional support for creating microservices in languages other than Node.js. So right now we support the latest version of Node.js 6.9, but we plan to jump into some other languages as well, which a lot of developers have been asking us for. So it'll be really fun to get that stuff out.
What's the authorization story now? Like if I wanted my customers to get an authorization token from, I don't know, Google or something, is there middleware or something I could plug in somehow?
No, there's no middleware. So you'd actually code that yourself. You'd take in like a keyword argument that somebody supplies to you when they call the function that you could just call like API key or auth key. And then you'd handle the auth layer yourself. So we're actually generating, we have a system built where every Standard Lib account can really assign its own API keys to other members of the account or to potentially to third parties. And then they can use those to access other Standard Lib functions. So that's what we've built out right now, and we'll be releasing within the month. So,
gotcha. All right. Any last questions, anybody?
I'm out. This is cool stuff, but no more questions.
It is cool. Anyway, Keith, thanks for being on and answering all these questions.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been great chatting with you guys.
And thanks everyone for listening. Hopefully we will talk to you again soon. Or we will talk to you again soon.
January 2018, we'll be back.